Does it feel nice to go around here walking on water that people know that you are on the hardest team, or is there a team to you that you would not want to join?
Well, actually, it's an interesting thing that you
don't say
bring print
because I know you're lying.
He's going to say no, but the answer is still yes.
No, so it's an interesting thing because I've thought about that on and off throughout the years, and
you've thought about how smart you are on and off over the years?
Well, that's pretty much daily, but no.
Welcome to You, Me, and IBMI.
Well, Alex, it's Monday and you are not in the office. What's going on?
It is too cold, Kurt. It was negative 10 this morning, Fahrenheit. That's too cold. And I had a vacation day. It's President's Day.
It is President's Day. So that's too cold for you to bike in, so you don't come in at all, or it kind of varies?
Well, it was a lot. I mean, my folks were in town, so they came over, and my kids all don't have school today. And obviously my wife doesn't go to her teaching job. So everybody sure. else had off but me, so I figured I'd take it off as well. And generally when I have a vacation day, I do not come into the office.
Yeah, that's sometimes that's a good plan.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah,
it's not very IBM-ish, but you know.
Who's that I hear with us?
But we have Layla in today for the podcast.
Hey, Layla.
So, you know, Alex, you and I started here in 1997, 1998, but we never sat near each other. You were always in some other area, but Layla and I were actually, you know, sitting right next to each other for probably 8 or 9 years. So, you know, it's interesting. There's people that are part of the center that we get to know really well. And there's other people that we almost never really see. So I figure by this time, Lael's probably really sick of me.
I know. I was pretty surprised that Lael eventually agreed to do a podcast with us.
Well, what was the trouble with getting him on?
I don't know. Lael, you seem like you're pretty busy. Are things pretty busy over there in internals?
Well, I spend a portion of my time on internals. So it used to be that a vast majority of my time was IBMI licensed internal code. But with Power 5, way back when, early 2000s, they converged the systems so that they ran on top of a Power hypervisor. And we became the Power hypervisor support simply in the respect that a lot of the development functions were similar. The developers were ex-IBMI developers. And so we had a lot of the skills necessary for that. So since then, it's been increasing more and more of my time is being spent on server firmware level aspects of things, whether that's Power hypervisor, partition firmware, or SROV support.
So if someone is to blame for killing the beige box, that'd be basically your team.
Well, the beige box was basically dead when I arrived in 97.
So really?
Yeah, I think I got to see the beige box for like a year. And then when I came in, we were just transitioning from V3R1 and V3R2 to V3R6 and V3R7 with the RISC or the reduced instruction set computer functions. So that was where we went into, let's see, yeah, so 3.6 and 3.7.
What year was it where IBM I started sharing hardware with other versions of IBM operating systems?
Yeah, so in Power 5, they converged the hardware. So, you know, previous to that, we'd had separate adapters, separate hardware, basically. And so, yes, the convergence for Power 5 was where we started to have the same underlying hardware. We still had some distinct adapters for AIX and Linux and IBMI. And over the next few years, they converted more and more into common hardware that can be used for both or all the different environments.
And that, I think that's an aspect of the system that has really been overlooked and not paid attention to enough by people in support who don't really have to deal with it. You know, like if you're in print, you don't really care what hardware the system is running on. You're just always looking at the software that's running on it. So I think it was years before a lot of people and customers really fully understood that there was no such thing as the AS400 anymore. What effects do you think that has on the system? I mean, do you think that kind of lack of understanding had any kind of a negative effect on the system at all?
Well, I would say for a long portion of time, especially when dealing with power servers, the systems continued to be referred to by a lot of folks as P-series systems, okay, which was what AIX ran on primarily. You know, that was the power. No, what did they call that? P was for performance.
Okay.
You know, an I-series is supposed to be for integration. Okay. Yeah. So even so, we had this converged platform, but we kept getting folks referring to it as the P-series system. And so there was a lot of time spent trying to advertise the fact that it wasn't a P-series anymore.
Right.
Right. It's now a converged system that can run all of these different functions.
Right. IBM I on power, AIX on power.
Right. That sort of thing.
And like Lael, a lot of systems are moving to the cloud these days. Like, do you have any feeling for the percentage of OS400 installations that are on a physical system in a lab?
Wait, Alex, you just called it OS400.
Yeah. So
there's no such thing as that anymore, right? It's just IBMI.
That's true. Yeah. Sorry. All right. I'll have to repeat that then.
Old habits. No, that's right. Old habits do die hard, though.
They do. Right. They absolutely do.
We get
do.
That all across, right? Yeah. I mean, you got this, what we would say are historically AS400 or System I or IBM I shops. You know, there's no real impetus for them to change how they refer to it.
No, there's not. Right. No. So. And in support, sometimes we're dealing with someone and you call it AS400 because, you know, it's just easier for them to process it and kind of move on.
Yeah.
But anyway, so do you have any sense for, are a lot of folks moving to cloud or are IBMI customers sticking with their local hardware?
Well, we're certainly seeing an uptick in the number of customers that are using power systems for other sorts of configurations rather than just solely for IBMI and dedicated hardware. So a lot more customers are moving into the virtualization realm where we have the capability of using live partition mobility to be able to move IBMI partitions from one server to another. You know, historically, it's been have two or three separate servers and you would just move the workload around between the servers. And now we're getting more of the capability of customers to be able to say, okay, I need to do maintenance on this server. I will use LPM or live partition mobility to move that operating system partition from that server to run on a different server. And so it's not maintaining three different partitions that are just ready to go when we have a problem. You can LPM the partition over, do your maintenance on the source system, and then if necessary, move that partition back. Does that replace the high availability configurations? No, not really. I mean, LPM is useful for planned maintenance. There is the capability for inactive LPM. So if your source server did crash, you can activate that partition on another server if you've set it up ahead of time. But in terms of true HA, where your source system or your production system goes down, you want to be able to pick up and go pretty much right away. And HA environments are still strong for that.
Okay, so let's say you're a brand new IBMI customer and you're setting everything up. Would it be crazy not to have an LPM scenario that would allow you to switch between servers as needed? Does anybody do that anymore? I mean, does anybody just have one system that they back up to tape on a biweekly basis or something? Or are those days dead and nowadays everyone's running some sort of high availability LPM situation?
Yeah, I think to answer your question about the LPM side of things, I mean, partly it's an adoption sort of thing, and folks are used to kind of the old school scenario of having internal disk units, and that was the best performance, and you would just have multiple systems that had that. And for a while, we also went through a phase of let's spread the workload out to multiple different sites. So if you have a business that has 100 stores, you might have 100 what used to be AS400 systems in those different offices. And then we went through a phase where there was consolidation and they would set up one or two very big central systems and the rest of it would just communicate in that way. But then you start to see a bit of a flow the other direction to go back to distributed computing. And then the processed data is sent back to a central location. So I don't know if there's a way to say that it's definitely one thing or the other. LPM provides a lot of flexibility and, I guess, to a certain extent, ease of use rather than having to maintain three separate environments for, say, a DR system and a backup system and then your production system. You can set it up in such a way that you can move your production around between servers. So there's benefits to pretty much all of those different configurations. I think LPM is one that provides a lot of flexibility, though.
One of the things I wanted to ask you was just on a personal level, Alex and I have talked about before about how we got into computing through just playing games when we were kids, and that doing that required you to actually know something about how to install and edit the configuration files and things like that. I don't think Alex and I, either one of us, really did a lot with programming, but how did you get into computing when you were a kid? Did you have a computer when you were growing up?
Yeah, so the first computer that I had growing up, and I actually still have it, is the Tandy TRS-80 Model 3.
Trash 80. Really?
Yeah, hey, that's true. It was called the Trash 80. But that's where I learned to program in BASIC.
Okay.
And actually, that was one of the first places where I played around with the computer systems and used them in ways that probably weren't intended. For example, I was thinking about this the other day where there's on the keyboard, there's this big orange button that if you press it, it just resets the computer. And, you know, that's fine. That's how you did it. There was a power switch on the side. But for whatever reason, I decided I'm going to hold down the reset button while I power the thing on and see what happens.
Oh, okay, sure.
And it brought me into a debug mode.
Oh,
you know, and I was playing around with that. I'm like, I don't know what I'm doing in here, but let's do it.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't my computer, so.
Whose computer was it?
It was my dad's.
Oh, okay. So he had it. He had that for work then?
Early 80s here, man. So
did your dad use computers for work?
He did. Yes. Yeah. So he was a city planner and did a lot of roadway planning and such. And part of that was doing CAD stuff in the early days of CAD, and he had a plotter that was used by that TRS 80 Model 3. that would basically use a pen to draw things out, yeah. which was really cool.
Yeah, I remember this. So you had a plotter in your house.
I did.
Oh, that's awesome. Oh, that's so, you've got to have had a better printer than me then.
That was pretty sweet to use that. And then the next real computer that we had was a 386.
Okay.
And our first game was one called Barbarian. And
I think I remember
that was Barbarian. A rough game. You couldn't get past the second or third level, you know, just because it was impossible to play. But yeah, in terms of programming side of things, the first game that I recall kind of getting me into that territory was called Knights of Legend. And I had an application on that for Norton. Oh, what was it called?
Norton Utilities.
Norton Utilities.
Yeah, Peter
yes.
Norton. Yeah, classic.
And it had a hex editor in it.
Okay.
And I used that to figure out how the save files changed when I spent one coin.
Okay, sure.
And so I reverse engineered the save files to figure out where the coins were at and gave myself a whole bunch of coins. And the game became quite a bit easier after that.
I remember doing that on Macs when I was in college, but I never had a computer when I was growing up. We had a good friend of mine. They had a computer. It was a Hyundai 286. And we'd play the old Sierra games like Leisure Suit Larry and, you know, different Space Quest, things like that. And but I never had one. We had just a keyboard, like a typewriter with a one-line memory in it. And if you wanted to spell check and you were a doctor, you had to buy an additional module that had complex medical words in it to put in to do spell checking. But I didn't have a computer till I went to college. So, Alex, did you have a Tandy too?
No, my folks had a 286. My grandfather was a lawyer, and I remember he had this enormous portable computer, quote unquote, because I mean it was this little bitty green screen, and I mean I don't know what model it was, but it was absolutely enormous, and it was basically a glorified typewriter. I don't know what he could have done with it, but yeah. We never had a Trash 80, never had a Commodore. I would have loved to have had an Apple IIe. But no, we didn't have one of those either.
We had a cousin with an Apple, so we played a lot of stuff. And they had the same kind of editing you could do with the games in there, too, with the files and stuff. You know, Alex, so kind of changing topic a little bit. We had Lug-In a couple weeks ago, and we were talking about things. And one of the people that I do think about when I think about Lug is, you know, in addition to Dutch and Dave, who was nice to meet, and Brad Mangus, of course. But I think about Lael, because a lot of those customers are people who have had very serious issues that I don't know if a lot of people other than Lael are equipped to handle around here. And I was thinking, what was the last really tricky one you've saved somebody's bacon on, as Alex would say, Lael?
Well, it's kind of a loaded question, but you're not wrong. I mean, I get involved with a lot of high severity cases.
Yeah, because, I mean, if something goes wrong with that internal layer or that hypervisor layer, nothing works, right?
That's true. If the hypervisor is having problems, the rest of the system is going to have problems. So the hypervisor is responsible for a variety of different things, but probably the most obvious or most at the surface would be the fact that it's used for dispatching processors. So if the hypervisor is not functioning in that respect, then the partitions are not dispatching their processors and you're not getting any work done.
It seems like the kind of problem that can only happen once, maybe twice, if customers are really forgiving.
Well, you're kind of setting me up here, but... Obviously, that's not something we want to happen. You know, I've been working with hypervisor since 2003. So we're 22 years of working with the hypervisor. So I've seen a wide gamut of problems. and it's not necessarily only once that a customer's hit a problem. You know, you get some customers who are like, how is it possible that I'm able to hit the once in a lifetime type of thing so many times? And to a certain extent, that tends to be customers that are pushing the limits, right? Which is good. I mean, that's what you want. They bought a system that is performing a lot of work and they're trying to get as much out of it as they can. And so you're going to get edge conditions that aren't necessarily reproducible in the lab.
Right.
So then you get a situation where, you know, they bump into something that we haven't been able to see because we just don't have that kind of workload pushing through on it.
Yeah, there was a case that Steve Hershey was working the other day where the customer had a system crash, and it crashed while there was still 10% of the space available in memory and on the system because they did not, they were using the system in such a way, like you said, it's an edge case. They're using the system in such a way that they didn't have any blocks of space on the system, I guess in memory or on disk, that were larger than like 64 kilobytes. So the system couldn't do any work because it couldn't grab and bring it up block. It was too fragmented, but they had done it so much that their fragmentation was just extreme. It was just taking all the space. So,
right. And that's an interesting sort of topic because the IBMI effectively has defragmentation built into the operating system. And so it's fairly rare for that sort of situation to happen. And that usually is implicit with a problem that, or with the customers that are doing a lot of small transactions. So things are flowing in and flowing out really quickly.
Sure.
Right. So it's, you tend to have more chance of fragmentation in a situation where there's lots of creations, deletions, quick transactions. So it's partly workload dependent that makes you get into a situation that might yield a result like that.
It just seems like a real challenge to me because, you know, I rely on doing similar things on a repeating basis to get good at what I do. And it seems like, Leo, with what you do, there shouldn't be a lot of repeat scenarios, right? Like every problem would be kind of unique, I would think. And if that's the situation, if that's the case, then how did you get good at what you do?
So I guess I would say that I've always had a penchant for digging into problems. Yeah, maybe deeper than the average person does. So I like to understand problems and or systems in as low detail as I can, low level detail as I can. That being said, when it comes to problems, especially unique ones that we haven't seen that sort before, the main item that I would go after is investigate the symptom. Right. So coming from IBMI and main storage dump review, what we've got to start with in many of those situations is what the symptom is to the customer. Right. We may eventually get to a point where we had to force a main storage dump on a partition, but you start with the notion of the console wasn't responding. Right. And so for IBMI, that's display 01.
Okay.
And so once we get the main store dump in, one of the first places that I'll launch to is taking a look at what the state of this display 01 job was. Right. If that's their primary indicator of the system wasn't functioning, let's start with that. In many cases, it cascades out to other sorts of problems, but it's a good place to start. In a similar sort of situation, they'll say the console wasn't responding and the interactive sessions weren't responding, right? So that gives us a hint that looking at things like the Q-inter subsystem you know, assuming that's the default interactive subsystem they're using, those two things, it's all, I guess, part of a puzzle. And that's one of the reasons that I like the job, is that, yes, it is unique many times, and that it's a new puzzle to solve. And you can have a common set of tools in your tool set on how to investigate problems. And to a certain extent, it's, you may end up with four or five different symptoms in a problem, and trying to use all of your tools for those various problems and saying, okay, how do these all fit together? And working it back, trying to come to a common source, if you will.
You know, what I was going to say partway through that was that, you know, I think one thing I've always thought about you when you've been, when I've heard you helping someone with a system or explaining how something works, is that you do always seem to have a really good understanding of an overview of like the big picture of how everything goes together. So that when something new pops up, it might be a new issue, but you know how to go at it because you know where, you know, because you know how the whole system works, new little issues aren't a big problem. It's like, if you know how to read a map and you come to a city, you understand, okay, this is, okay, I've never been to this city before, but that doesn't mean we're not going to be able to very easily drive down the street, you know, and expect kind of how things should be working when we have that good kind of overview of, well, I know kind of how this is supposed to be. I don't have that with Save Restore yet, but I have that with print. And once you kind of get that, you can get at something from a multitude of other places.
Yeah, and absolutely. I think getting to that point of digging into a problem or digging into how things work before you get into a problem is really useful. And that's one thing I encourage folks that are new to IBM. You know, my main interest when somebody coming in is not that they know the specific technology or the latest, you know, the latest way to use the system necessarily.
Yeah.
But it's more to have a creative approach to things and a curiosity to dig
curiosity.
Into.
Yeah, curiosity. That's kind of what I'm hearing, Lale. Sorry to interrupt, but I think that your job would be particularly difficult if you didn't have a lot of curiosity about the system before problems started coming in, right?
Having a level of curiosity about something is, you know, frequently I'll work on a problem and that's interesting, but I will go a little bit further and try to figure out how is it that that piece worked together, mm-hmm. right? So I may have already resolved or gotten enough of an answer to the customers so that they can move on, but it triggers a whole cascade of questions in my head about how does this work? And I really dig into that to try to figure that out.
So, Lale, what you said was when new people come in, you like them to have a curiosity about kind of how the system goes together and not necessarily dig into any one, maybe one particular aspect.
So when I'm talking to someone who's new, usually when I'll start out with a couple different things. Like I described before, be curious. Mm-hmm. You know, if there's something that makes you think, you know, why does it work that way? Dig into it and figure it out. Another piece that's kind of connected to that is if there's something that annoys you or you wish could operate more smoothly, dig into it.
Right.
And you probably can have the capability of making it smoother. And it helps a lot of other folks. So a number of my tools that I've created were primarily created to resolve problems and speed up review for myself. but I've been able to open them up for other people within the support center to be able to use to good effect.
One of the funniest things I ever saw here was you had gotten a case and then you'd read an update in the case where you're reading and you're like, man, this is just a really nice summary of what this problem is. And then you realize you had written it. It was a tool you had written to analyze that particular log that would put out in a paragraph form the summary of it. And you didn't realize that you had written it yourself.
Yeah.
I thought that was great.
It's a compliment both on the skill that I had when I wrote it and the fact that my memory must be going.
There are so many things I think we've all written, like updates to customers, and we look at them later and we're like, how did we write that? Not that it doesn't sound like you, but you're like, I understood that back then. I don't understand that now. Like, okay. I hit that a lot.
And then the other thing that I would say, and I just bring this up because it caught me earlier in my career, was that when you get into a meeting and folks are throwing around acronyms, because IBM loves their acronyms,
yeah,
and I imagine that's fairly standard across the industry, is if you don't recognize the acronym, stop right there and ask what the acronym means. And that's a useful thing. You know, for my example, there was a meeting that I had where I was assigned a responsibility, and this was in the first couple of years of my career here, and I thought I understood what they meant, and I thought I understood what the acronym meant, and then like 3 weeks later, they said, hey, so-and-so has not heard from you at all, and I said, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
So they were saying, the acronym that they had used was completely different than what I had thought it was.
Oh, wow.
So I had misinterpreted and gone down a different route. So in any case, you know, I recommend that. And is that everybody's scenario? I don't know. But, you know, if there's a concept or an acronym that you don't recognize, stop right there and get it clarified right at the beginning.
When you started, who was the person that mentored you and kind of showed you how stuff was working and how did that work?
Where I started from when I came in, I got hired into a team, and the explanation of what I would be doing was that I would be working on a team that developed tools for the system, right? And for debugging problems. And when I actually got here, I didn't end up on that team at all.
Oh.
So I got involved with the license internal code, partly because it was low level and it was probably the closest to when I was in school. I'd, you know, enjoyed assembler, and license internal code is, you know, kind of one step removed from the assembly level on the system.
Oh, it is. I didn't know that. I know a little bit about assembly because in college I was way into the demo scene. I didn't write any, but I was really like those 4K demos and people kind of do all they can with like just a very small amount of space.
Mm.
You know, that was kind of a 90s thing, I think.
So got into the license internal code team, and since I enjoyed that, but I also wanted to dig deeper, I got involved with the team that was responsible for AS400 dump review.
What was that team called?
It was screen team.
Oh, that was the screen team.
It still is the screen team, yep. So
what is screen team? I've never known what that means.
Well, the basic idea is that we screen problems before we get them to development.
Oh,
so
you screen dumps to see if there are any nuggets of wisdom that.
Well, yeah, I mean, to a certain extent, what we're trying to do is to not inundate development with a bunch of problems that we've already seen, right? And this is kind of our job in support anyway, right?
Yeah.
It's to be able to answer problems we've seen before, and for new ones, be able to collect the right sort of data and get it to the developers so that they can most efficiently work on problems, but also continue to work on development of new function without as much interruption, if you will. So for Screen Team, that was primarily it. With main storage dumps, we would get it. And since license internal code underpins a lot of function in the system, right? It's an integrated system. So we have database and save and what we call load dump type functions and storage management. It's all built into the operating system. And we have license internal code portions of all of those things. When we get a generic failure for IBMI license internal code, we have to be able to take a look at it and say, okay, now based on what the problem is, I need to get database involved or I need to get storage management involved.
Sure.
So in that respect, we're kind of technical routers, if you will. So that was the origin of Screen Team in terms of really delving into it. Tony Staub, who retired some years back, was definitely pivotal in terms of getting me deeper into things and answered the questions when I wanted more in-depth answers.
So career-wise, like you were always planning on a career in computer engineering or computer science?
I would say I was fairly targeted in that respect. You know, I felt like I could have done a lot of different things. And, you know, as you're going through college and coming out, there's certainly the feeling that maybe I'm closing the door on something else by pursuing this aspect of things. But I enjoyed playing with the lower level pieces of computer systems. And so it fit well with me, and I like solving problems. So
yeah,
all those things fit pretty well with me.
None of your kids are thinking of IT careers, though, are they?
That is correct so far. So I've got one, my oldest is going into occupational therapy, and my second is pursuing bassoon performance.
That's awesome.
And then my youngest, she's still in high school. So,
yeah, unless you can consider video games to be an IT career, none of my kids are interested either.
Hey, you know, there's all kinds of studies that say that it's good for pattern matching and eye-hand coordination. So, you know, they're going to be stars in their own right, I'm sure.
Right, right.
So there are certain teams in the center that we all instinctively know are harder than other teams. For example, I think I'm started in print. I freely admit print is one of the easier areas, I think, to be in. There are other areas like database, maybe to an extent, and internals that the other people that work in those areas, we look at and go, okay, they know more about the system than I do. Like, it took me probably 10 years to realize that a spool file is just an entry in a database, that it's not its own little thing. But I don't work in database, and it wasn't really that important to my job. So it never really hit me like that. Does it feel nice to go around here walking on water that people know that you are on the hardest team, or is there a team to you that you would not want to join?
Well, actually, it's an interesting thing that you
don't say
bring
print because I know you're lying.
He's going to say no, but the answer is still yes.
It's an interesting thing because I've thought about that on and off throughout the years. And
you've thought about how smart you are on and off over the years?
Well, that's pretty much daily, but no. In the situation where I'm like, I like license and internal code, and I like the hypervisor because we are kind of the end of the road, right?
The buck stops here.
To a certain extent that, yeah, but I have a trouble with things like the notion of client access and that I'm, in some cases, you'd be the middleman for problems. You're like, yeah, that's a Windows problem, or that's a problem with the network, or, you know, things like that. And I'm like, end up having to work with the customer and then also a different aspect because I'm in the middle of this thing.
Happens right? all the time in print.
Yep. Happens to be all the time too.
Right. But when it comes to license internal code, there's nobody below me, right? There's True. The developers and then there's the people that are having problems. And so in a respect, to me, it feels easier to work with the end level of stuff than being in the middle trying to negotiate different aspects of things. So, you know, I don't know. I can get frustrated with my PC because there's aspects that I can't control about it. And maybe that's comes down to it. Maybe I'm a control freak or something. I don't know, but,
well, maybe,
yeah, maybe.
Yeah. I can totally understand not wanting to send customers away, to either fix their own problem or to a third party, software, solutions provider. You know, we're working on language and utilities. A lot of customers will have their own programs that they're having problems with. And, you know, that's outside the scope of support line, right? We cannot debug customer code. And it feels a little weird to send them away. You know, it's like,
right. You want to help resolve their problem, but at the same time, it's like, there's only so much you can do.
Well, yeah. There's certain cases where like, you know, that if you send the customer off, like if somebody calls in and they have a printer that is not printing, it's not working, and you know it's a printer problem, and you tell them, well, you have to call the printer manufacturer. You know, almost 100% of the time when that customer calls and they say, I'm having trouble printing from my IBMI, the instant reply from the printer manufacturer is going to be, we don't support IBM. And I always have to coach people like, okay, when you call them again, tell them, I'm sending a PCL data stream to a PCL capable printer that you invented. you should be able to fully support both of those things. I'm like, don't mention IBM. Just say it's a printer issue.
You're not wrong. In many situations, yeah, you mention IBMI, and that puts folks into a deer in the headlights sort of look.
Yeah.
Like, you mentioned something that I don't really understand.
It's an easy out.
Yeah. So you just gotta, like you said, you gotta coach them a little bit to be able to say, okay, let's break it down to the bare essentials. Yes, there's IBMI involved, but that's not really the problem.
Right.
Right. So
yeah, we get that a lot.
Yeah. In terms of the, you know, kind of goes back to your question or your comment before about being able to explain problems to customers. And for me, being able to understand the technology to a, what I would say is a deeper level, is a big piece in being able to explain that to customers, to be able to say, hey, you know, it seems complex. It seems like a black box, but it's not really that complex. Let's break it down to its base pieces, and this is what's happening. And that helps a lot in terms of especially those critical problems, being able to come back and say, yep, this was the outcome of it, but here's the main things that caused this type of thing, and say it in such a way that is understandable. So that has helped me quite a bit throughout my career to be able to do that.
Yeah, I think being able to break things down and explain them in a way that's straightforward and kind, I think, is really key for that. And I've heard you do that sitting next to you for all those years. I heard you do that many times. So, yeah, I've never heard Alex do that though.
Half my job is to blame somebody else for the problem.
It's a license internal code problem.
It's a layout. Yeah. Let me comment you in. Well, what's next for you, Lael? What do you, you are also a triathlete?
That's true.
Are there any winter or spring triathlons you're looking forward to doing?
Well,
are there such things as winter triathlons? It's like negative, what, 15
degrees? There are, but it don't really involve swimming.
And they don't involve you.
They don't involve me. That's true also. Yeah, there are ones that I've seen in, usually in northern Minnesota, that'll involve like fat tire bikes that can go across the snow, and then skiing, and then some third sport, whatever that is.
Yeah.
That's not my shtick, but yeah, the earliest one I've got is in the beginning of May.
Okay.
And since it's still very cold in this area, the swim portion is in the pool at a university, and then you get out of the pool and go bike. In this case, I think it's about 15 miles in 50 degree weather, which is cold on its own.
Yeah.
If you just get out of the pool.
Where's that one going to be?
That one is in Waverly, Iowa.
Oh, nice.
Down at Wartburg College.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's cool.
You know, if you're in the Midwest and you're looking at doing a good starter triathlon, one I will recommend to everyone is one called Trinona, which happens in Winona, Minnesota.
Okay.
And it is an excellent starter race, and I've done it every year since 2016. And it's just a ton of fun.
You swim in the Mississippi then?
The lake that we swim in is called Lake Winona, which technically probably is fed by the Mississippi at some point, but
okay.
It's kind of locked in there. So,
okay.
Yeah, but it works out okay.
Yeah. Well, that's awesome.
Cool. Other than that, I've got two or three other triathlons that I've signed up for this year and just getting in shape to do those things.
Yeah. I should start working out because I hit 50 and instantly.
That's the perfect time to start working out.
Well, usually I can eat whatever I want. And then, you know, everybody says you can't do that because eventually it's going to catch up with you. And I say, no, it's not. And then it does. And it doesn't go away right away. So
is that you're only 25 years behind everybody else. So congratulations,
man. Yikes. I got to do something. You know, podcasting, if you move your mouse a lot when you're editing, that's some calories.
Yeah,
there.
That's a serious flex there.
We should do a podcast where we're on our bicycles or something.
That would be something.
Well, Lil, I just want to thank you again for coming on the podcast today. You've been a reliable and dependable team member for the IBMI Global Support Center for many years. We rely on your expertise. And you just make all of our jobs easier.
Thanks a lot, Lyle. That was a lot of fun. Very interested to hear your career trajectory and what you do here in the center.
All right. Thank you.
All right.
Best of luck to you.
That about wraps it up for another episode of...
I thought we were all going to say it together.
Okay. Okay. We can. Let's all say it together.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks for joining us, Lyle, on
you, me,
and IBMI.